Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of the Security Repo Podcast. We are here with another very interesting episode off the heels of KubeCon, if you were there in Paris. We're here joined by John Dietz, who is the co-founder of KubeFirst. He has over 20 years experience in lead roles in the IT field, including testing, performance, development, data, DevOps, platform architecture, and cloud engineering. So a man of many talents, to say the least. He's been instrumental in moving USA Today to the cloud and has been helping companies adopt Kubernetes since 2017. So John, thanks so much for coming to the show and sharing your knowledge with us today.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you for having me on today. It's going to be good to talk with you guys. You've been a fan of the security space forever. This is, I think, my first ever security focused podcast today. So I'm very excited to be here with you guys.
Super happy to have you. Hey, before we get started into the conversation around security, though, I've heard you speak a couple times now, and you always have an interesting story on how you got into Kubernetes, like how you were very anti-container for a little bit there. I would love just you to share that with the people to kind of paint the picture of how you got here.
Hey, well, thanks for starting out with the softball of me being a hypocrite. It's true. I started out, like my intro described, I've kind of been in the DevOps space forever from a whole bunch of different perspectives. And when Kubernetes was a young pup, I heard all the words that Kubernetes was saying, and I had heard them all before. It seemed like, frankly, just another hot buzzword that was going to come through and wow everybody and fizzle out, and in would come the next flash. And I was working at USA Today at the time. I was in the middle of this enormous on-prem to the public cloud migration. We were also migrating from Microsoft Windows to Linux. We were also migrating from ASP to Node.js. So it was a enormous overhaul of technology at the time. And we had, I think literally, like it must have been the same week that we turned production on Linux and on Node.js and in the public cloud for the first time. And then like, it was like one day later, it got thrown into the conversation. Hey, maybe we should re-architect everything for Kubernetes. And we had just migrated, 250 microservices to new containerized implementation. So I wasn't a fan of the idea at first. And I ended up leaving USA Today for a startup. And my director at USA Today was the new CTO at that startup. And his directive was, you're going to run my infrastructure and we're doing Kubernetes come hell or high water. I don't care what you think. So so I had to roll up my sleeves and learn Kubernetes the hard way, just like most people have to. You start reading the internet and find out that it's all full of lies, and you start trying to put tools together the wrong way and you're picking bad stuff. And then you start to find some patterns that are good and some tech that works together. And 9 to 12 months later, you start to feel like you understand the space and you've built a decent platform. And that's kind of how we got started at KubeFirst. And after building our first platform on Kubernetes, it was just obvious how different it was running software on Kubernetes than running software on any other combination of technology that you could ever think of putting together. And I was sold concretely, to the point that the only problem that I saw with Kubernetes was how long it took to get a platform built using open source tools. You can obviously buy your way out of it, but a lot of organizations are using, like almost every single organization is using the same 10, 12, 15 tools in order to run their cloud native platforms. We're all, you know, we all have very similar ideas about infrastructure as code and secrets management and how to get applications into your cluster and GitOps and, you know, the right way to manage your certs and the right way to manage your DNS and the right way to manage your ingress into your cluster are all stories that we've all kind of been beaten up by, and we understand what the best of breed tools are now. And yeah, you can deviate on one or two of them here and there, but my passion in the space is just, okay, well, can't we all just start on day one with all of the best open source free tools all automatically working together? So that's kind of been my passion for the last 5 years on the KubeFirst project is trying to lower the barrier of entry into Kubernetes and make sure that organizations are pulling value out of Kubernetes on minute zero instead of having to wait that 9 to 12 months of building in order to start pulling value out of it for your organization. So that's kind of the origin story of KubeFirst and my introduction to Kubernetes. A little bit long-winded, but it's been a long journey.
Well, I mean, I really relate to a little bit of what you're saying, because before GitGuardian, before I got into security, I was working with another startup where I was a CTO over there, and we had decided to build like on Kubernetes, and this is in 2017, so you know it's still fairly-ish early days, and like I had no idea really what Kubernetes was, but it's such a good decision. Because had we not, it was such overkill at the start and such a painful process that it's so easy to say, let's not do that. Yeah. However, it ended up being a great decision because it was scalable and so much easier to move forward, like kind of from that perspective. So I understand you, but it like, yeah, at the start, that initial thing, trying to get moving. And even if you're small, it's a painful process with Kubernetes.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, you'll start down the journey and you'll discover some huge element like GitOps, and it can change your mind completely on everything that you're thinking that you should be building and how you should be going about your architecture. And you know, you have it's tough to absorb those hits and pivot and make good decisions on the right way to tackle platform building for your organization and what the needs are from an oversight standpoint and from an automation standpoint and from a transparency versus security standpoint. And it's a fun little monster working with Kubernetes.
Kubernetes really hand in hand with infrastructure as code. Like they're not the same thing, but you can define Kubernetes with code. So it's part of that larger picture. And that's really what we wanted to bring you on to talk about, is that larger picture of not just running this stuff, not just building this stuff, but ultimately the security around how do you manage this stuff. And you have a really interesting perspective on that around governance. Like, how do we bake security into governance? But before we can talk about security through governance and all of this, let's talk a little about what you mean by governance. And that's a term I think it's fairly not new to people in tech, but what specifically we mean by governance with IAC and with Kubernetes?
Yeah. Governance is one of these terms that kind of gets thrown around and dropped in the same bucket as like compliance requirements, and everyone's eyes kind of glaze over and hopes that some other person in the organization is responsible for that job. And the reality is that governance is one of the most critical elements of infrastructure as code that your organization can make strong decisions on in order to secure the posture of your security team and your platform engineering team. So, you know, when you're, IAC is really at an interesting time in its evolution. You know, you think back to just 5 short years ago, and HashiCorp Terraform was an iron grip king of the space. And there really wasn't very much in terms of automated tools to run that Terraform for you. And the world just kind of, everyone agreed that infrastructure as code meant a certain thing. It meant that you were going to have some repository, some code repository where you're going to write some code, and that code represents your infrastructure. And you can just lay down, you know, if you need a VPC in your cloud, you get to write down a declared definition of what that VPC looks like. And then inside that VPC, if you need a Kubernetes cluster, boom, you're just going to write one more little snippet of code that represents a Kubernetes cluster. And then if you need S3 bucket to store your state, if you need, you know, volumes in order to have persistent volume in your data, in your data space, then you can just kind of add more of these IAC components and build out this whole cloud. And the selling point that got us all writing IAC in the first place had nothing to do with governance at all. It had everything to do with repeatability. It was just, you know, well, do you want to be able to build out your production environment and then pick that environment up, move into another cloud account, and then recreate that exact same environment? If the answer is yes, then maybe you're interested in Terraform. Or do you want your production and development environment to not have drift from one another? Another great use case for IAC. And that was just the way the world worked. And people were using Terraform mind-blowingly as a command line tool. It is a command line tool. It's not that mind-blowing that you're using it as a command line tool. Every organization under the sun had SREs and cloud engineers who were just running Terraform on their laptops. And that pattern continues today because those organizations still exist. They still employ people. They still teach those people how they run their infrastructure as code. And that's just sort of the way that the world 5 years ago required us to think about IAC. But the reality is that creation, day zero, is just the starting point of IAC. And once you create your production environment, for example, you need something in place for what we call day two operations. And day two is just a fancy name that means the day after everybody stops paying attention because it's brand new. That's day two. And day two doesn't last for a single day. It lasts for the rest of your life until you destroy that project. So with day two operations, you get an opportunity to add automation to your IAC to protect you from drift. And you also get an opportunity to decide what your governance model is that's going to oversee your automated operations. And the governance model is different depending on whether you want GitOps to be managing the state of your resources, or do you want a human being to be a part of that workflow? And you know, when Crossplane came into the scene just a handful of years ago, what was striking about Crossplane was that unlike Pulumi, unlike Terraform, that said, we have a command line tool, and that's how you run infrastructure as code. Crossplane changed the game and said, we are Kubernetes native, and we are going to lean on that Kubernetes control plane to drive the desired state of what you want for your infrastructure's code, and make sure it matches your actual state. And you're not going to have to run a command in order to see if it's any different, in order to detect if there's drift or not. There's just going to be a system running. And if you bind it to GitOps using like Argo CD or Flux CD, then you get to leverage the Kubernetes engine to make sure that that state is being evaluated and assessed against what's actually in your production environment immediately, instantaneously. And if anything's different, GitOps with a IAC governance model can just say, you're not allowed to have drift. Anything that you do that makes this infrastructure as code different from what was desired, I will destroy and replace it with what was specified as the desired state, which is a really, really impactful capability from a provisioning standpoint, like when you're talking day one operations, being able to create 100% of your cloud, your account, your IAC, your VPC, your Kubernetes cluster, you then bootstrap all of your applications into that Kubernetes cluster, you grant people access to that Kubernetes cluster, all of that stuff being run through GitOps in a day one type of big bang explosion is incredibly powerful. And we should never be working to take that away from platform engineers. But as soon as it's done and finished being created, you have to make a decision, a governance decision, about whether you want the machine to be keeping an eye on these resources and what the rules are, or if you want a human to be involved in that workflow. And so there's some neat things that you can do with Crossplane combined with Terraform, which is kind of a crazy half sentence because a lot of people consider Terraform and Crossplane to be in competitive space with one another. And they sort of are. They both do native infrastructure as code, but Crossplane allows you to create that without the command. And because they let you create that without the command, you can establish GitOps as that governance model with no additional tools required. You can just lean on Kubernetes. And if you need additional safeguards to make sure that your Crossplane engine doesn't decide in the middle of the night that it's time to replace your production cluster, you can lean on policy as code tools like Caverno to decorate your production resources and say, this one's not deletable. Even if GitOps decides that this production cluster needs to be destroyed, we're not going to destroy it today. And so you still have those human thought mechanics that you can build into your GitOps workflows if you want a GitOps governance model. But if you prefer to have the human eyeballs and really have like an actual human being say, hey, that plan says it's going to delete my production cluster, I would like the ability to say no to this pull request, then you can switch that governance technology away from GitOps and towards something more like Atlantis or Env0. They have these tools in the space that will run your Terraform plans for you, integrate those plans with your pull request so that you can see what would happen if I were to say the magic words to this governance system and say, yes, this is okay. And only under those human typing circumstances will it actually apply the change that it's proposing is going to happen to your system. So a lot of people find that's a much more convenient, a much more comfortable governance model for their production resources. And frankly, there's a lot of organizations that require it from a compliance standpoint, that like they will have a human being in the decision-making process of that production cluster getting destroyed. And if that's a part of your compliance requirement, then you better have it as a part of your governance model as well. So again, a little bit long-winded, but a little bit of a complex topic when you're talking about Crossplane and Terraform and governance models.
Yeah. There's a lot there. Yeah. Because we had some questions right now. We were like going through like, okay, he's answered this one. But it's been perfect. And this is exactly why we want to have you on the show to talk through this, because there is a lot saying on here. And what you're saying about the GitOps too, it's when you're to rely solely on the machine component on that, it just sounds terrifying. My perspective, this the thought of like, even if everything worked out, the thought that something's just going to destroy all, like, you know, all the clusters, rebuild them all, and you're not going to know, like, that just seems terrifying.
it's both terrifying and somehow it's also encouraging. Like when you buy into a full GitOps owns everything Borg type of system, you can literally go into your production cloud, into your cloud's console screen, and go to your production cluster and click the delete button on it. And if you have bought into GitOps concretely through your whole organization, that cluster is going to get destroyed. And then you're going to have a management control plane that's responsible for that production cluster. And it's going to recognize, hey, that cluster doesn't exist. I'm supposed to have one of them. I'm not going to ask any questions. I know I need a production cluster. And it's going to create the production cluster. And then it's also going to have the bootstrapping mechanics built into the same GitOps that says, this cluster is not supposed to be empty. I'm supposed to have cert manager, external DNS, Ingress Nginx. Let me unfurl all these applications into this cluster in the right order so that all the chicken and eggs of all these application interdependencies are all shaken out. And then after, you know, it truly takes about like 7 minutes. You can go from a brand new employee accidentally hopping into your cloud and deleting your production cluster with no questions asked and having that cluster build itself back up and unfurl with all of the exact same applications in the identical state that they were all in the last cluster, and nobody typed a single command. Nobody ran anything. There was no run list. Nobody knew what the versions of anything were that were in that last cluster. It was just being kept track by the GitOps repository that's running the system. And so there's an encouraging element about that power that's the opposite side of the coin of the fear of buying in to allowing the machine to make those decisions for you. And they're both correct. The question is, what resources should stay in that GitOps governance model, and what resources should deviate from that GitOps governance model and have a human involved? And we've pretty much broken it down in our minds as a starting point, at least. It's going to be different from org to org. But as a starting point, your security pieces, your IAM, how you give humans access to your cloud, how you give humans access to your code, and how you give humans access to your secrets. If you can keep all of that in a non-GitOps, human-managed, you always get an opportunity to see what's changing, why it's changing, and you get the opportunity to say, we're not going to change that. And if you do that on your production resources, your security resources, and your IAM resources, then you're really setting yourself up in a solid posture to allow the system that you now trust to be able to make its own empowering decisions on the governance of your development environment, of your staging environment. Those aren't critical. If you lost your development environment and you knew that it could be recreated in 7 minutes from GitOps, it's not the end of the day to allow the GitOps system the opportunity to do that. And if you do that, there's just a lot less mess that you have to tend to, because every time you introduce a human, you're introducing a little bit of mess. So yeah, that's kind of where we always start with governance and GitOps versus governance in something like Atlantis is leave Atlantis for the high security, for your security cluster, for your control plane cluster, for your production cluster, your IAM tools, and everything else is really fun and fast and powerful to have in a GitOps oriented governance model.
I'm briefly interrupting this episode to talk about the security repo's sponsor, GitGuardian. GitGuardian is a code security platform that specializes in detecting secrets in your development workflows and also in your code repositories. Not only can GitGuardian bring to the surface all of those leaked secrets from way back in the history in your projects, but it can also let you know when systems have been breached by using their brand new HoneyToken module. HoneyTokens are fake credentials that you can put in your environments and also in your third-party tools to know when they've been compromised. GitGuardian is free for all teams with less than 25 developers. You can sign up today at gitguardian.com. All right, back to the episode.
Yeah, I have like 20 more questions on this, but I have to rein myself back a little bit because I want to drill down into some security focused questions. So one of the things that we really like to do here at the Security Repo is start fights on the internet with people. So let's start one of those. That is... So one of the things with IAC is that, you know, it's a new technology. And it's incredibly powerful. But when you're using declarative infrastructure, when you're declaring the state of something and you're not building it through traditional methods, let's say, it's easy to declare something that may be insecure or areas like that. But who should own security when it comes to infrastructure as code? Should it be the security team? Or should it be the DevOps team, because the security team don't necessarily understand the implications, or the DevOps teams don't understand the security? So, you know, what's your perspective around where do we stand in DevOps and security when it comes to privacy?
It's a great question. I'm not sure I could even imagine an answer that appeased every listener. And I think
well,
that
we don't want to appease listeners. No.
We're fights off. Yeah, forget about these listeners. These listeners
argument on Reddit tomorrow. That's what we're looking for.
No, yeah, we it's interesting. How do I frame that? The size of the organization that you're running infrastructure as code for will dictate largely who the correct team is to be responsible for the security in your organization. If you're at a tiny SMB, and I've been at tiny SMBs, I've literally been the only cloud engineer at a company running Kubernetes. And so I was also the security team, and nobody had any choice because I was the only one that could get security into the system. That doesn't mean that I was proficient at securing a system. And as we grew, so did our DevOps team. And as our DevOps team grew, it became more transparent and more obvious the separation of concern between what the cloud engineers needed as we were building a platform for software developers and what the security team needed as they were building security to protect the needs of the organization. And those two are not always necessarily in alignment with each other. And the question that you're asking really highlights how platform engineering as a discipline evolved. It's because in order to run a Kubernetes cloud native centric platform for your organization, you have a whole bunch of different concerns. First of all, you have a whole bunch of tools, and those tools, all these cloud native tools all need to be configured. They all need to be managed. They all need to be updated with a regular cadence. They need to be scanned. They need all kinds of stuff going on. And you need somebody managing just that workload alone without the mindset of security. But there should also be a security-oriented mindset in your organization that deals with the rules of your compliance requirement, the posture that you want to have from a standpoint of outside access, from the standpoint of inside access. Do you want your developers to have access to get inside your production cluster is a very common example of organizations needing to answer tough questions. Once you have a platform, it starts to become easier. Once you have a platform team, it starts to become easier for that security mindset to incorporate its goals and objectives into something. Otherwise, you're just kind of shouting at 100 developers in 100 different directions, you know, hey, everybody, this is what we're trying to do from a security standpoint. And it's truly up to the developer to implement that. And that's terrifying because the developer has a lot on their mind and security isn't always top of the list. From a platform team standpoint, you're able to abstract a lot from the developer in your platform. You're able to establish security rules that nothing gets into the platform without abiding by those rules. And you get to burn those rules into your platform, but it takes a lot of high tech to get that right. And a lot of security teams aren't going to have that technical prowess about infrastructure as code and cloud native tools and the right way to abstract that away from your development teams. So in my opinion, it's a hard question to answer succinctly. I think that the security team should always have a say in the way that your platform is constructed and what the compliance rules and boundaries are of that platform access. And that's where it's best to start. As the security team needs additional things, they need security scanning. You can build that into the platform so that every time any microservice is building and shipping to DevStage Prod, it's going through this new container scanning process so that we're not putting vulnerabilities in production. You can, if you're talking about how users get access to new Git repositories, that's another thing that you can bake into your platform so that nobody can get a new Git repository without it being created by infrastructure as code. And that's been abstracted from the implementation in a way where all the right teams with all the right access get all the right access to that brand new repository. And there wasn't a human going around making mistakes, making misconfigurations. It's all built into the platform. It's all transparent. It's all obvious and it all works the same way. And that's the direction that I always try to get new organizations to think about establishing and baking those security opinions into the platform instead of just kind of throwing it over the security fence and saying, hey, security team, can you go ahead and make sure that this whole system over here that we're building at lightning fast pace is secure and ready to go? That's too tall an order to just have a fence in between your platform and your security organization.
It very much sounds like you're talking about the true meaning of shift left. Get not just, hey, here's another tool to throw into your stack developer to mess up your workflow, but let's look at the whiteboard and see like, what are you about to design?
100%.
Where's security fit into that early in the conversation, getting those embedded teams truly embedded and like, working side by side, which is a challenge I think everybody faces out there. I want to shift over a little bit to some like real world stories. Again, not revealing any customer names, but you've worked with a lot of people over the years to put this stuff in place. And I'm curious, just like, what are the common missteps you've seen companies take? What are the common situations that you've seen people get into? Or you walked into situations like, we just got this wrong and we need to figure out how to unwind this when it comes to security, at least.
Yeah, no, it's a really good question. I could probably talk until it was dinner time and hang out at your house all night. One of the biggest things that keeps coming up, because cloud native is still relatively new, there's still a lot of larger organizations that are just starting that transformation out of, you know, maybe they're running containerized apps on VMs, maybe they're just running naked applications on virtual machines, and they have hundreds of them, and they're paying the bills, and everybody's happy. But there's this promise of Kubernetes that has them tempted enough that they're starting to make that transition away from their sort of VM-oriented architecture into a cloud native oriented architecture. And there was an IT posture when VM oriented architecture was the new hot thing. IT companies looked differently. We had a different fingerprint. We had a different DNA. There was an IT team that if you needed something, we weren't that removed from a day that didn't have a public cloud yet. And if you needed new stuff, you had to ask the IT department, usually through a ticketing system, you know, hey, I would like these things to happen. And the IT team has to do things like IAM and has to do things like set up your SSO and has to set up your access and has to do all of these things for you. There's a lot of resistance in the transformation into cloud native to allowing Kubernetes to be the king. There's a very comfortable posture in a lot of these larger organizations that haven't really taken the plunge into cloud native yet, where there's just a wall that's always going to exist. And there's a whole bunch of manual setup stuff on the IT side of that wall. And then once they do their manual stuff through tickets and everything, Then, you know, maybe if they did everything just the way you asked for it, you'll be able to do your cloud native GitOpsy stuff frictionlessly and effortlessly. But the reality is that Kubernetes has this way about it where once you start adding stuff to Kubernetes, it starts to become more difficult to not have Kubernetes in control than to allow Kubernetes to just keep owning everything. And that will regularly include everything in IT. It'll regularly include all of your IAC for your IAM permissions and for your single sign-on users and for what those SSO users have access to from an OIDC standpoint to your different platform tools and what the reasonable accesses are for all of those different groups that you have in your organization. And you know, should your testers have the permission to delete an application in Argo CD, for example? You probably don't want that. If you have bought into Kubernetes concretely and left the world of, you know, IT departments that aren't part of the journey behind and brought that IT team into the Kubernetes space, brought that security team into the Kubernetes space, that's when you get to realize the full power of Kubernetes. But so many organizations are stuck in their way of having an IT team that's over there, and they're going to be responsible for your IAM, they're going to be responsible for your SSO and your OIDC rules and all that kind of stuff. And then you're just kind of trapped in whatever you're left with. And you have to make concessions and you have to sort of organize your cloud native world because there was this more clunky IT oriented department that was more ticket laden and not really part of that flow. So the faster you can bring your security team into your cloud native journey, the faster you bring your compliance team into that journey, the more frictionless you're going to end up with a platform that accommodates the needs of that security team and accommodates the rules around safeguarding the configurations that you need to protect from a governance standpoint. Hope that was sort of clear enough.
No, especially that last point you're making there with the silos and teams not talking to each other. I was just at Scale, Southern California Linux Expo, and part of that was Upscale, which is a fun event. They had Forrest Brazil, I forgot to say his last name, but the guy that wrote the reorg rag, which is like, we used to have two teams, and it's this whole fun ragtime, you can find on YouTube, ragtime number, and it's like, we used to have two teams that didn't talk to each other, so we made DevOps, and now we have three teams that don't talk to each other. And it just, and it spreads out from there, it's funny. But yeah, it is the problem. But thanks for shedding light on the governance on this kind of stuff.
Always a pleasure. Always a pleasure.
Well, I have a question whilst we're talking about this is, you know, like you're very passionate. You can tell it, you're giving in your answers. And we love having people that are passionate about technologies and want to learn more. But I guess like one of the questions is, you know, why on earth do you care so much about things like Kubernetes adoption?
Man, that is that's such a good question. Why do I care about Kubernetes adoption? I spent my whole career searching for this holy grail of being able to have everybody in your organization be able to observe everything that the organization has and understand it. If you look 20 years ago into the early days of my career, it was a pipe dream. It was impossible. CI/CD had barely made its way to the keynote stages. And automated testing was the new hot thing, right? Over the decades, we have made stride after stride after stride at solving the pain points of writing software and shipping software and managing software and observing software. And here we are in 2024, and Kubernetes has taken over all the clouds. I can take, for example, the KubeFirst platform, not to turn a late question into a product pitch, but the KubeFirst platform installs a lot of apps, and it delivers a ton of capabilities so that you can just run a single command and you'll have everything. You can start with nothing but a DNS, and after you run a single command, you can have a cloud that has a VPC, that has a Kubernetes cluster, that has HashiCorp Vault with Secrets Manager, with user management, with group management, with OIDC, that's automatically hooked into Argo CD and Argo workflows. And you have Argo workflows that's integrated with self-hosted GitHub runners and GitLab runners. And you have certs that are automatically provisioning and automatically renewing because you have external DNS that's automatically keeping your DNSA records bound to your load balancers and blah, 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 blah. Like, I could go forever about all this stuff that happens from a single command against a single cloud. And I can take that entire platform of literally hundreds of cloud native applications and pick it up and change one detail about that command. And now I can have all 100 of those applications, but they're running in a new cloud, or they're running on my laptop, or they're running in a highly available mode in multiple clouds. That sentence has never been true until, like, I don't know, last year. And that is so exciting that we have gotten to the point where, and truly it was GitOps that gave, well, it was a combination in my mind of Kubernetes as the engine and GitOps as the discipline that opened an opportunity for us to be able to have a desired state that an entire organization of engineers are allowed to all read, and we're all allowed to see what is the state of 100% of all my applications across all of my environments. How were the applications delivered? What version are they on? Everybody is allowed the same opportunity to understand the system. And that's been a pain point of mine for my entire career, is that as an admin, I get to see a system that a lot of my engineers don't get to see in a lot of my old companies. And that's very frustrating. Because if you're depending on your developers to help you secure your system, they have to be able to see it. And with GitOps, you're allowed to transparently give to your entire organization, your developers, your testers, your security team, your CEO and CTO, you name it. Everybody gets to see what the rules are. And with that knowledge and power, you're allowed to define how you're going to help protect the system in a way that we've just never had before. And so, you know, I think that Kubernetes opened my eyes to the ability to deliver software, complex microservice software, to in a portable way to environments that you've never seen before. That was a fallacy until Kubernetes. Kubernetes was truly like, I mean, maybe you could say AMIs too, but AMIs weren't very comfortable. And Kubernetes is truly, truly portable. And so that's what sparked the passion. And then when GitOps entered the scene from an operational discipline standpoint, that was everything. That was the missing piece to allow that transparency so the whole org could see what the rules were. And when you buy into GitOps, you get this new opportunity to change your security posture so that the rules are all about that main branch of that Git repository. And protecting a main branch of a Git repository isn't very hard work. It's work that pretty much any DevOps engineer that you hire for your company should be able to do. They should be able to take a GitOps repo and protect that main branch so that only people that are supposed to be able to change it can change it. And if you can set up that as your foundation, then you get an opportunity to say, these admins are allowed to approve and this bot is allowed to approve. And those are the only people that are allowed to approve. And that opens the entire organization to contribute to the platform. But it keeps the oversight of the platform in the hands that are supposed to have the oversight. So, I think that's just an evolution in IT that, if you're old enough to have gone through all the different evolutions like I have, it's been a long time coming. And it's got me more passionate about the space than ever before, to be so close to that holy grail that I've been searching for so many years.
I know exactly what you're talking about. I'm old enough to remember all of this too. But I was there when we went from, you just deploy your website on whatever host you built it locally, you deployed it host. So there's a two-step to dev test live. Mm-hmm. Like that is the mentality. That is how this is going to work for everything moving forward. Let's get into that mindset. And I had a passion about it back in the day when I was at Pantheon for that exact reason. It's like, this is the future. This is not just a cool tech. This is a fundamental change in the way we approach this problem set, and watching that come to fruition. And now it's absurd that you wouldn't have a test environment. Like, why? How could you not push this to staging first?
I know.
It's exciting to watch those kind of shifts. And that's why we brought you on the show, because of that passion you have. I just want to say one caveat out there for everybody that's listening. If you're new to infrastructure as code, this has been a very dense episode. And I'm kind of realizing that as I'm reflecting here toward the end of our recording. I would encourage everyone to not see it as like, well, I don't know anything. See it as a opportunity to like, what on earth is Atlantis? What on earth does he mean by GitOps? And start digging into these concepts. That's why we bring experts on the show. So not to make you feel like, I don't know what he's talking about, but to expose you to new tech that maybe hasn't hit your radar yet, that definitely is going to.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, 100%.
Yeah. I think you could spend a couple of days like digging into these parts, which is really cool. That's why, I love the style of the show and who we bring on the show, because this is what adds value. Before we go, and we're starting to wrap up, but we have a quick game that we like to play with everyone. Now you're coming from a infrastructure point of view, so this is going to be interesting. But we like to ask everyone, what's the best security advice that they would give someone? And what's the worst security advice they've received or have heard? So I want to start with what was the best. In relation to Kubernetes and IAC and everything that we've discussed here, what's the best security advice that you would give someone?
I think the best security advice that it's a little bit selfish of me in my mindset, but the advice that I would really encourage anyone that's getting into cloud native for the first time to take stock in is that groups and user access to your cloud native tools is easy to ignore upfront. It's easy to hop into your cloud console and create a Kubernetes cluster. And your cloud console, whatever cloud you're in, they're going to give you some easy way to get your hands on this magic kubeconfig file. And if you have the kubeconfig file, depending on the cloud that you're in, a lot of them have the token that accesses the cloud directly in that file. So that is an administrative access key into your Kubernetes cluster that I've seen in organizations, people just shipping around that file, and that's how people get access to Kubernetes. And when you're part of a new startup that's just kind of going 1,000 miles an hour, it's easy to slip into that mindset of, yeah, I know this isn't really the right thing to do, but I'm just going to send that kubeconfig file over to my buddy in the next aisle over here, and we'll circle back to that in about a week. But you work at a startup, and a week turns into 2 weeks. And then after 2 weeks at a startup, there's no way you're thinking about what you were thinking about 2 weeks ago. And that will just take a long time to circle back to. And the reality is that pattern that you did, that you established by handing that file off, that pattern is going to propagate from app to app to app to developer to tester to blah, blah, blah. So the best security advice I can give to anybody getting into cloud native and Kubernetes for the first time is to think very, very early about your minimal number of groups that you want to give access to both your cloud, your cluster, and the tools within that cluster, and get that detail established first, not second. Get it established first. And you only need two roles to start. You need admins, and you can call the other one engineers. And put everyone in engineers, put yourself in admins, never put anyone else in admins. And if you start there, you are setting yourself up for half a year of refactoring down the road that you won't have to do, and a very, very painful overhaul operation that nobody wants to go through. You're going to have to update apps that developers haven't touched in 4 months. You're going to have to do all kinds of horrible things if you don't get security set up upfront. So definitely encourage that as the best advice that I can give is get an admins group and an engineers group upfront day zero, and then build your system from that point forward. And then as far as bad advice, I was once told, I was once a cloud engineer at a very small SMB. It was an SMB that I started out being the only cloud engineer, and the company grew. And it became a team of two DevOps engineers, and I met my co-founder at Coop first, my buddy Jared. And then we turned into a team of three, and then four, and five, and six. And when we hit number six, we said, hey, there's a lot going on this platform. We need a security team. We don't need security built into the platform. We need a security team. And it was a good decision, but we didn't do a good job following through. We handed over security controls to the security team and we stopped looking, and we stopped working with them. They weren't a part of the flow of platform building. We built the platform, they did security. There was a wall in between us, and we as platform engineering practitioners expected that security was going to be able to secure the platform that we were building, that we weren't doing a great job talking to them about, that they weren't doing a good job being proactive about discovering what we were doing. And the end result was pretty catastrophic. There was an event, there was a security breach. It was because of a change that they made to the platform that we didn't know that they were making because we weren't a part of their workflow. They were making that change because they weren't a part of our workflow. So they weren't putting their changes into our platform. They were just making their changes in their silo, and we had no oversight into them making those changes. And they ended up, for convenience, allowing an onboarding process that allowed a backdoor entry into a self-hosted Git system. And that was not a fun thing to discover. And when you ask yourself five whys enough, you get to the end result that the security team and the platform team should not have been siloed from one another when they were making changes to the rules about access to the system. So I think the worst security advice I got was to hand security over to security and stop looking and just focus on my platform. We all, whether you're a platform engineer, a developer that doesn't even care that there's Kubernetes in your shop, but there is, you are still on the hook for security of your system. The platform team is, the security team is, the testers are. We all have to do security together. And if you ever hear advice to that's the security team's job, be cautious about that guidance, and always keep your guard up for yourself around your platform. Is the best advice I can give, I think.
Yeah, I love it, and I completely agree. Well, look, we have come to the end of the show. It's been fascinating. So much information in here. Just if our listeners want to follow you and maybe learn more about what you're doing, what's the best places? I know that you're also an author on the news stack as well. Where can people kind of follow you?
The easiest way to find me is on LinkedIn. I use that kind of as my fire hose of everything that I'm up to. And I'm easy to find. If you can find Coop First on LinkedIn, then you can find me on LinkedIn pretty easily. I'm also available on Twitter at Vitamin Dietz. That's the last name is spelled D-I-E-T-Z, Vitamin Dietz. And happy to talk to everyone from the most grumpy seasoned veteran that just doesn't believe a single word I'm saying, to the most noob of noobs that wants to know more about what these pods are that are running in their Kubernetes cluster. I'm happy to field and talk and converse with the whole spectrum. So I would love to hear from all of you.
Amazing.
I just want to say thanks for being here and thanks for bringing so many topics to light. Again, this is a very dense episode, but one I think that people can extract a lot of value from, and just really want to say thanks.
No, it was a real pleasure hanging out with you guys for a bit today. Really, it's been a lot of fun talking through and kind of going through the mental exercise of breaking down the foundations of platform building and security and governance and IAC and all that stuff. It's just a joy to talk about for me. So I really appreciate you guys having me on.
Awesome. Well, thanks again for coming on, and we hope to have you on the show as a guest again soon.